Stress is a real killer, and what I'm going to do is talk a bit about stress, first of all, what it is, understand body chemistry about it, and then we'll talk about some strategies of how to manage and prevent it from wrecking us. To start with, what I want you to do is talk to the bloke next to you. What are the things that stress you? What are the things that drive your stress up? Okay, so chat to the blokes next to you. Go for it. So without you giving me any feedback, I'm going to tell you what stresses you, okay? These are the things that cause you stress. Anything that annoys you, anything that threatens you, anything that prods you, excites you, scares you, worries you, hurries you, angers you, frustrates you, challenges you, criticizes you, or reduces your self-esteem. And the truth is, if you don't have some stress, you're dead. Okay? That's the truth. The issue is not necessarily having stress. It's actually getting into distress. And there is good stress and bad stress. But our body doesn't know the difference between the two. So you can have a quotient of good stress, and then you can have a bad stress. Put them together, you get double, and that has the same effect on your body, whether it's good or bad. Your body doesn't know the difference. Okay. Professor Archibald Hart says stress is this. Stress is a tension inside of us that results from pressure either from our social environment or our physical environment or our own expectations. Anything pleasant or unpleasant that arouses your adrenal system and mobilizes your body for the fight or flight response and doesn't let up and allow time to recover can predispose you to stress disease. Your body simply adapts to living in a constant state of emergency and you feel discomfort until the damaging results occur. He goes on to say that stress can be self-abuse, but not all stress is bad. Okay? I'll just go back to that. So, really understanding that stress is a natural phenomenon, and there are things that we can control about stress, and there are things that we can't control. And so we've got to learn to know what we can control and how to actually manage that. Stress burnout often manifests itself in depression or anxiety, and when someone has stress burnout, you're probably talking 3 to 7 years to recover. So we'll see this with a lot of pastors that get stress burnout, Christian leaders, CEOs, and they take a holiday, but they actually don't have a holiday. They actually try to recover, bring the level back down, go back into the heat of stuff. But significant stress burnout, the 3 to 7 years recover. But generally, it presents with depression. There is a difference between depression, anxiety, and stress burnout. There's subtle differences, but it'll often present with that. And one of my associates in my practice, Richard Fay, which has been with me now for a year. Richard was a senior pastor of a Baptist church who had burnt out 3 years ago. So he's well into his recovery. He's doing quite okay. And he's studying part-time, doing a master's degree, hence he's ended up in my practice. He's a great counsellor. But he knows stress burnout firsthand. And we did a program on radio on stress burnout, Richard and I and Dr. Carolyn Russell. And one of his pastor mates in the US listened online and text him and said, I wrote 9 pages of notes of stuff that he wants to change in his life from the program. So the external stresses come in two things and the internal come in two things. So there's the organisational structural management stuff and the nature of the job, and then there's the health issues and interpersonal issues. So these things over here, you know, lack of support, lack of debriefing, structural issues. So structural issues are often management issues that cause incredible stress. And I'll give you another example because I know there's a couple of pastors and, you know, when pastors actually have to deal with a leadership that's a really difficult leadership, that's a structural issue. That alone can actually escalate stress. Or if you're a man on the land, you're a farmer and you got some suppliers and they change management and they want to stuff you around and they won't listen to reason, you know, it's stuff that you don't have control of and it's the structural issue, it just drives you nuts. Your stress goes up. And so that's when we're talking about structural issues. The nature of the job is that particularly conflicts, challenges, but also things that have generated excitement are pretty good, or things that are really challenging threats can really create stress. Health issues, so what happens is depending on our physical health, it depends on our response to stress. So in fact, when we get a cold or a flu, we actually have a little bit of a stress reaction that's a little more like a depression. So you get depressed because your body's tired. And so what happens is your ability to cope changes. And then we've got the intrapersonal issues. So my sense of identity, my sense of insecurity, my sense of self-esteem are really, really important to actually how I deal with stress. How does it impact our body? And I'm going to come to this a couple of times. I'm going to talk about this as a framework. So what happens is our body takes us in through our senses something that's an alarm. So the alarm goes off in the body. The body then activates to respond to that. But then after the activation is that we're supposed to come to recovery. So what happens in our body is that our five senses pick up information, and then our brain and our adrenal system, and I'm going to talk a lot about brain and adrenal system in this. So the adrenal system is just above your kidneys, right on the inside of your kidneys is your adrenaline glands. And so then what happens is that when it's done its job, everything's supposed to shut down and our parasympathetic nervous system is supposed to cause everything to go down and we go back into rest. So we go, oh, that's over. But the problem is that many of us go alarm activation, alarm activation, alarm activation, alarm activation. All right, we actually don't get into recovery. And that's why one of the things. Now, a little bit about the brain. Brain has got three parts. So basically we talk about the brainstem and the cerebellum coming up as the primitive part of the brain. Then there's a part of the brain here called the limbic system. And then the cortex wraps around here and the prefrontal cortex. Easiest way to understand this, if I make a fist, put my thumb in the inside of the fist and put my finger in here, I've got the human brain. So I've got the spinal cord coming up. The thumb is the limbic system and then that is the cortex. Now, what happens is that the limbic system is where we store our experiential memory. So it's not historical memory. It's experiential memory. So if I said, tell me about your best holiday ever, is that you go to some part in your cortex and start recalling the story and the facts. And as you call the story and the facts, it triggers your limbic system and all those good feelings start to flood in. All right? But you can't recall the feelings. You trigger the feelings. Now, this is very, very important because what happens is that the limbic system is like a computer hard drive in a storeroom. Now, the hippocampus is a microprocessor, and so in this part in here in the brain, the hippocampus is down here, the hippocampus actually allows encoding. And so the size and the health of the hippocampus is really important. And as part of this is the amygdala. Amygdala means almond. So it's the size of an almond. For women, they have a bigger amygdala than blokes. And that's why they tend to be more emotional and emotionally responsive. Because the amygdala is where our emotional memory gets stored in here. And that's like a warning alarm. So what actually happens is that think of the limbic system as like an alarm system, fire alarm or an accelerator. So our senses take in all this information, says there's a threat, and our limbic system goes, bang. And when our limbic system kicks in, generally it's going to be fight, flight, freak, or freeze. The two common ones are fight and flight. So my limbic system goes, get ready for a punch-up, or do a runner. So you know when you're driving your car and some lunatic does something stupid in front of you, and all of a sudden you're pumped and alive? You've gone from information in, alarm, activation. Your limbic system's fired off, which has fired off your adrenal system. Now, the cortex that wraps around the part, particularly the prefrontal cortex, this blue bit here, but the cortex is this bigger bit here, it's designed to hold the power of veto. It's like the brake or the voice of reason. So what happens is information comes in, limbic system fires off, frontal cortex says, false alarm, slows everything down. That's how it's supposed to work. But sometimes, is that when we're stressed or if we've experienced trauma in our life, is that we don't develop the pathways from the front here to the limbic system. So what happens is that we go bang and there's no break. And if you think about particularly your sons, if you've got sons when they were little tackers, you know, and you go near a road, you hold their hand because they're just impulsive because they don't have a frontal cortex. Their cortex is not developed. They don't develop that till about age 4. It's all limbic, reactive, 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 reactive. Now, give you an illustration of limbic system. I've got a clip here, and we'll get as much sound as we can through this. And with this limbic system, watch this guy. He's reading a newspaper, and watch when it changes. Watch his limbic reaction kick in, all right? So he's here drinking his coffee, reading his paper, and this attractive lady's flirting with him, and she comes over and writes on his paper, and his limbic system goes boom, bang. And he probably walks away from him and goes, why did I do that? See, the limbic is all about past experiences. So let's imagine that he shared a room with his brother, and his brother used to take all his stuff. Maybe wrote on his books. So encoded in his limbic system is a response that says, you know, it's my stuff, don't touch it. So she comes along, writes on his paper, triggers his limbic system, his frontal cortex doesn't even kick in, there's no break, just bang. Now you can imagine what this is like in marriage, because you walk in after a hard day's work and she says something to you in a particular tone and you interpret it and you go, bang, your limbic system comes out and attacks, and then her limbic system, well, what are you tackling me? And then you just dig your way to China, because it's all limbic reaction. And so it's easy to say put the brake on, but putting the brake on is not easy. Now, so what happens in the body is this. Is up here in the brain is the hypothalamus. The thalamus is underneath the amygdala. So the thalamus just sits right underneath the amygdala. So what happens is you have all these sensors come in, and so you get the internal external stressor, and the limbic system fires off, and the almond part, the amygdala, sits underneath the thalamus and says, alarm, 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 alarm. Now, what happens then is that it sends a signal to the pituitary gland, and the pituitary gland is just coloured there on this bloke here. And so you get this chemical called ACTH from the pituitary gland, and that gets tied off there on your spinal cord. And then what that does is that goes into your bloodstream, and that goes to your inner and outer cortex of your adrenal glands. Your adrenal gland is just on the kidney here. Now, one of my scientific colleagues said, you know, alarm to activation is 1, 2, 3 steps. And she said, to apply the brake is 7 steps. So it actually takes a lot more work to apply the brake than it does to go to activation. So it's much easier to go to activation rather than actually get the process of going to put the brake on. Now, what happens here with the adrenal glands is absolutely critical. Because what happens in there is that the outer cortex of the adrenal gland produces cortisol and cortisone. And this is what this stuff does. It fights inflammation. It increases your muscle tension because, you know, you're getting ready to either do a runner, okay, or do a punch-up. That's what you're getting ready to do. It frees fatty acids, it increases your blood sugars, and it's neurotoxic. So cortisol, more cortisol we have in our system, the writing of pathways to calm down gets harder. The more cortisol we have in our system, the less healthy functioning our brain has. So here's a real catch-22. You get under stress, your cortisol goes up, and then your brain's not working properly, which increases your stress. So really, big dilemma. Now, the inner cortex of the adrenal gland produces adrenaline and noradrenaline. And adrenaline, you know, we hear about adrenaline junkies, and why are adrenaline junkies adrenaline junkies? Because adrenaline is one molecule different to cocaine. All right? So adrenaline is highly addictive and gives a massive rush. And you don't have to pay for it. That's why they love it. You can't get done for possession. But it's got its cost. It's got its cost. So what it does, it activates the heart muscle, increases your cholesterol. So there's lots of people who are on low cholesterol diets who've got stress and their cholesterol's not going down because their body's producing it. Sends glucose to the muscles, raises your blood pressure, and increases your heart rate. All again to get ready to do a runner or for a punch-up. Fight or flight. So let me come back to the earlier one of alarm, activation, and recovery. So the 5 senses pick up on imminent danger. The amygdala and the left orbital cortex overseen by the prefrontal cortex. So these guys fire off, and this brake says false alarm, real alarm. If it doesn't, then it's just automatically perceived as a real alarm. So then what happens is the thalamus turns on the sympathetic nervous system, which kicks in your adrenal glands. And then after it's all over, then we're supposed to go on recovery when the parasympathetic nervous system kicks in. And then we go to bed at night. And when we dream, we file everything away during the night and our chemistry balances out and we produce brain chemistry that gives us good, healthy, balanced life. Now, every one of us dreams, we just don't realize we dream. So our system is designed, alarm, activation, recovery. But the problem for our culture is that when we get to stress burnout, which is on the increase, is because we don't go into recovery. we sort of skip this step and then wonder how it's going to work. But it's not designed to work like that. We're not machines, and even if we were, machines still have to be serviced. They still have to have downtime for servicing. We've got to have downtime to allow for recovery. So, what's the impact of distress? Well, what we'd say is the technical term is we get a dysregulated nervous system. So our brain and our central nervous system throughout the body gets out of whack. And so then the first common thing is that we get prickly. For most of us, our fuse gets shorter, we get irritable, we get cranky, and then people go, oh, I feel like I'm walking on eggshells around you. You know, because we're just wound up. And that's a dysregulated nervous system. And that's really, really tough. Now, what I want to do is I want to talk a bit about what happens with a dysregulated nervous system in terms of the brain and brain chemistry. So there's five key chemicals that we have in our brain. So there's adrenaline that gives us the rush. There's serotonin that gives us the blissful feeling. There's melatonin that helps us sleep. There's cortisol that is a result of stress, and too much cortisol is neurotoxic. And then we have dopamine, which is a precursor to adrenaline. So, boys do a lot of dumb stuff because they have dopamine and testosterone. Dopamine is the risk-taking hormone we have. Combine that with testosterone, you've got a great combination. No, like nobody teaches little tackers how to climb the cupboard and jump on the bed just to see how high they can jump. They come up on that all their own. And then when they're 14-year-old boys, they can actually take some really dumb risks because, you know, they think they're invincible. Cross the road and play chicken with trucks. Because that's dopamine and testosterone. Now, what happens is that when our nervous system gets dysregulated, is that generally what happens is the adrenaline goes up and the cortisol goes up, is that the serotonin and melatonin drop. They drop significantly. And as a sideline issue here, is that people with depression, anxiety, or stress burnout, is that when they're medicated, we're actually using new forms of antidepressants that are working on serotonin. Older forms of medication were tranquilizers that bomb people out. The newer forms of medication is to actually help the brain produce more serotonin to get the chemical balance right. I have generalized anxiety. It's hereditary. I've been on antidepressant medication for 8 years. Every time I think about going off, I have an anxiety attack, so I'm not ready to go off it. And what it does is it actually brings my serotonin levels up, which then improves my melatonin and improves my sleep, which allows me to regulate my system better. But what often happens is that one of the biggest misunderstandings about stress and people who need to be because of depression and anxiety is that medication's a bad, bad thing. But it's not. It's actually working particularly on that. There's a new family of medications just started that works on melatonin. That's called a melatonin adjuvant. We've got the first one out and it actually has got almost zero side effects. So it's quite amazing. Let me talk about these chemicals a little bit more. Serotonin is a very powerful neurotransmitter. So, what these things that get messed up when you have serotonin, okay? When your serotonin drops, your memory starts to go. You know, when you're under stress, you can't think things that you used to be able to, you weren't sharp enough on the mind. Your appetite goes, either you don't feel like eating or you overeat. It can be both extremes. Your mental functioning doesn't work as well. Your mood changes and your sense of movement gets changed too because you get lethargy that goes with the mood. And then your wake-sleep cycles get messed up. So the first telltale thing about sleep, first telltale thing of stress disorders or stress distress is normally somebody's sleep is bugging. So one of two things will be happening. They can't get to sleep. They climb into bed at night and they're racing mind. They can't get to sleep. Or they go to sleep, but then they wake up early in the morning. But they don't wake up in the morning going, oh, great night's sleep, ready for the day. They wake up in the morning and drag themselves out and go, oh, another day, and just push themselves. All right? It's an absolute telltale. So just to reinforce is that these are the five things that serotonin affects. Sleep, food, exercise, thoughts, and your stress levels. Now, if you're struggling with stress issues, that produces your serotonin to go down, then you're going to have more stress because your serotonin's gone down. Now, we can't measure serotonin because we don't jab big needles into people's heads to go, oh, let's take a bit of a, you know, we know the symptoms. And what we do is we look for the symptoms that help us to understand what's happening there. Now, adrenaline. Yep.
I
No, they actually, what they're called, the main family is serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So there's a mechanism that serotonin's produced and reabsorbed in the neurotransmitter. So what it does is the reabsorption bit is blocked. So you're producing serotonin, but you're not absorbing it as much. So your overall serotonin levels come up. That's the design of it. All right. And there's two other families that work different mechanisms, but it's about helping the brain get its serotonin levels up. So it's not replacing serotonin. It's actually helping the brain produce more serotonin. All right. So, and that's really, really important. And because these chemicals are right in the core of the brain, is that you have side effects when you take them because you're witnessing your brain chemistry. But when it levels out, people go, oh, wow, it's out here. I've got clarity now. All right, it's not overwhelming in their face. Huge difference. And so if I have someone with stress burnout coming to me, one of the first things I'll do is work with a GP to get them on the right medication. And a lot of GPs are not mental health savvy, so they actually don't manage medication as well as it could be. My supervisor, my clinical supervisor, is a psychiatrist. He was actually the director of training for child and adolescent psychiatry for Queensland Health for 10 years. And then I've got three or four doctor mates who are mental health specialists, but also trained as counsellors. So I have the privilege of picking their brains. And I say to them, I can teach this stuff better than them because I'm not a medico. Because I don't use medical language. But I understand this because I've been taking an SSRI. Can I ask what you're on? I'm on Lexapro. It's great medication. All right. Couple of side effects that I don't particularly like, but, you know, I can live with those. But absolute clarity in my head. All right. Sometimes you can get a dry mouth with Lexapro. Each medication has different sort of side effects. You get a dry mouth. The one that I don't like is it just makes it a little bit harder to climax sexually. Okay, that's the one that I don't particularly like about Lexapro. But I can live with that for the benefit of having the rest of the anxiety managed and allowing me to do what God's called me to do. Because my anxiety will stop me from doing what I need to do if I let it. All right, and I hope that I won't be on medication long term, but if I have to, I'm not going to lose sleep over that because it's about a balanced life. All right. So when we get adrenaline, we tend to feel in control when adrenaline's running through our system. We can deal with many things all at once and we're able to make rapid decisions. You feel like you can do superhuman things. You think faster. You draw on untapped energies. You can work all night, perform acts of superhuman intellect and ability. It's heady stuff. It's easy to see how someone gets addicted to it. And what happens is those who are born, some people are born with a higher adrenal level than average. I'm one of those people. So in my younger years, you know, I could go and go and go and go and people couldn't keep up with me and that was cool. But I describe it like this. I was born with higher adrenaline levels, so I'm revving twice as fast as everybody else. But what that means is I use my petrol quicker. And I get to a point when there's no more petrol in the tank. It's not sustainable. And so when we get to stress burnout, our system gets depleted and we can't function. So what happens is the net effect of abusing your adrenal system is a direct increase in your cholesterol levels and a lowering of your serotonin levels. Cholesterol leads to heart disease and premature death. Serotonin is your feel-good drug. Low levels of serotonin have been linked with depression, anxiety, and in extreme cases, multiple personality disorders. So let me tell you how stress can kill you. One, is that when your stress levels go up, your adrenal levels go up, you actually get more blood in the brain. So initially, you're alert and sharper in your thinking. But then what happens is you can't sustain it and then you get mental blanks and losses and your thinking gets a bit whacked. Second thing is that your heart rate increases and your blood pressure goes up. So coronary heart disease is a really big issue. And so often with people with stress burnout, they've got elevated blood pressure. Third one is that you produce a lot of gastric acid. So people get ulcers, stomach ulcers, because what's happening is that your system is trying to dump everything and get it out of your guts and out of your bowel because you don't want anything if you're going to do a runner. So, you know, if you actually have to speak sometime, you want to go to the toilet and you go to the toilet a lot before you speak because that's your adrenaline kicking in and it's actually emptying your system. All right. Third one is that your muscles get tense. Now, I wish it was like the Hulk, but it's not. It's very, very common for people with stress overload and stress issues is that they get complaining of sore jaws, they have tension in their muscles, neck, shoulders. They're going, oh, I wish I could just loosen up and relax. But their muscles are on tight all the time because that's what adrenaline does, is that it actually tightens your muscles up ready for activation. What happens with your breathing is your breathing shallows out. So rather than breathe your diaphragm, you actually breathe the top part of your lungs, which means you reduce the oxygen in your lungs. And so that actually then slows down how much oxygen you're getting in and out of your system, and you can catch people. So when I see people with stress, you can see they're often breathing just this part. They don't breathe the diaphragm. And the last one is it's very common for people with stress overload is they have actually had cold hands and feet. So they climb in bed, and the wife says, oh, don't touch me, your feet are cold, your hands are cold. And the reason being is that the extremity blood from your extremes are taken to your vital organs because it's not needed there, it's needed here. So what happens is your hands and feet get cold. And as I present, my hands and feet are cold every time I present because my system is under adrenaline load. Now, is it bad stress? No, it's good stress, but my body doesn't know the difference, so I have to manage it. So it's very common for me to go, oh, my hands and feet are cold. That means my adrenal system's under load because my blood from my extremities is taken to vital organs. My doctor, I've had terrible blood pressure over the last few years, and so I'm on blood pressure medication to bring that down. And that's to go with my generalized anxiety, which is hereditary in my family. So my younger brother has it. My mum and her two sisters have it. It's rife through my families. So I'm prone to anxiety and I'm prone to stress because my adrenal system's already up. And so part of that has been bringing my blood pressure down so that I don't burn my heart out. Because my doctor said, you know, if we don't get your blood pressure under control, you'll blow the motor. And unlike a car, you can't replace the motor. That got me thinking about this clip, all right?
I've got sandwiches here.
You finished yet?
Yeah, look at that. Look.
He's burning a bit rich, I'd say. Oi, oi.
So, every time I go to the doctor and my blood pressure is not a good place, I think of this clip, you know. So, one of my GP counsellor mates, Dr. Carolyn Russell, we did a presentation. We'd done a number of presentations over the year, but we did one on stress and burnout. And she came up with this matrix, which is really helpful. So the physical reaction is that we're either going to do fight or flight. So we can do fight in lots of ways. We can be edgy, short, cranky, a sharp edge, sarcastic tone. That can be fight. Flight can be really simple, avoiding, procrastinating, putting stuff off. Then the mental reactions are freeze and freak. So the freeze is like the, you know, stunned rabbit in the headlights. You just don't know what to do. Or you freak, where you run around going freaking out like crazy, you know, and your brain is going a million miles an hour. And so she said we have the fighting freezer. So the fighting freezer is that, you know, they actually want to fight, but they don't know what they're going to fight about. All right? They've just got to fight. Then you have the fighting freaker. So, you know, their brain's going a million miles an hour, their mouth's going a million miles, and their arms are swinging everywhere. And then you've got the freezing fleer. So, you know, they want to run, but they're just frozen. And then you've got the freaking fleer, and they're the one who are going, you know, don't panic, don't panic, don't panic. Those of us old enough to know Dad's Army, you know. Yeah. All right. Yes. You know. And so you get the freaking fleer is, you know, don't panic, don't panic, and he's freaking out and he's running off, you know. So then what happens is that you've got a sociopath. So most of us are not going to fit in that. I don't think any of us should fit into that. A sociopath is someone who has no moral sympathy or understanding. So what happens is that they do their fighting, but they've got no reason or understanding why they're fighting, and they can be quite nasty. So then over here, it's a really scary person because they've got lots of noise and lots of solutions, but they don't work. Then you have the one down here is that their brain stops, but they want to run away. And then you've got the one down here is the brain's going nuts, but they still want to run away. Got the sociopath there again. So then what happens is that they have an external focus, so they've got to fix everything out there, but nothing works, so they blame everybody else. All right. Then this one here has an internal focus, but what they do is that they have very negative thinking about themselves and they often end up in depression. And then this one over here is they do a bit of blaming of others and self. As they flee, they blame people and scream and blame themselves, and so it's a little bit more outward, whereas this one is actually a really quite an inward process. Now, that's just to say that's the sort of reactions that we have, and there's a few nods so people are identifying with some stuff. These are the really key questions about where am I at with my level of stress? And so these are really important questions. Are you beginning to drop the ball on important projects? I don't expect you to answer this out loud, just think about it. Do you feel overwhelmed more often than you think you should? Do you frequently feel worn out at the end of the working day? Do you feel let down by people more often than not? Does your body ache, particularly when you stop being busy? Have you been too busy to call close friends and family members? Have you lost your sense of humour? Does sex seem more like trouble than it's worth? And do you have less to say to people in social situations? And with that I'd pay is that you actually have not had fun and play in a while. And if it's yes to the majority of those, is that then there's an indicator that your body is actually starting to be in distress. And that distress is never sustainable. In a moment, we're going to talk about some preventative strategies. So I've got a clip in here, which I have in for no reason of stress, really. I like the clip, but there is a reason why I do have it, which I'll explain in a moment, all right? The clip is called Old People Driving. And the reason I put it in there is exactly that, is to give us a laugh. Because one of the things that we do when we distress is we don't laugh enough. And laughter is one of the great antidotes for stress, because what happens is that it produces endorphins and enkephalins, which are opiate-based hormones, that's the feel-good hormones, that make us feel better. And they counteract some of the adrenalines. But what happens when we're under stress, we don't find a lot to laugh about. And I'm really good at making sure I've got stuff. So I've got whole heap of clips like this. I've got Fawlty Towers on DVD. I got Black Books on DVD. I got all these wonderful comic things that I can just put on a laugh. And so when I'm stressed, that's the time I need to watch it. But my brain will say, I'm too busy, I need to do this. But I actually have to train myself to go, no, it's time to actually have a laugh. I haven't had a laugh for a while.
Do some people with stress find other humour?
Mm-hmm. That can be a real defence mechanism to deflect. So your humour can be deflect. But having a good belly laugh, that's a different ballgame. Now, when I was a kid, I used to go down the park and we actually had real seesaws. Not like these ones they put springs under now and wobble. I don't know what you call them, but they're not a seesaw, are they? Wobble saws. Yeah. And when I was a kid, I don't know about you, but I'd get out of the park and the top of the seesaw was up here somewhere, you know? It felt like it was an eternity. And I grew up in a housing commission area, and so what happens that at the park, if you wanted to be the king of the park, what you had to do was get the seesaw balanced and see how far you could go out and keep it balanced. And if you could be the furthest, you're the king of the park. All right? Now that's the points which are called the limits of balance. And if you have too much tension or too little tension, it falls over. And so here's the point. Is to keep things balanced, it's about tension. So we actually have to have the tension, the right amount of tension, to keep it in the balance. The second thing is we have to stay in the limits of balance. Now here's the tricky bit. No two people's limits of balance are the same. And my limits of balance today most likely won't be the same tomorrow. So my limits of balance are constantly adjusting. So if I'm feeling fit and well and healthy, my limits of balance will be out there. If I pick up a cold, it's going to come in here. It might go back out here. And then if I'm stressed, it's here, you know. And if there's something happens in my family emotionally, it brings it in here. It's constantly moving. So here's the tricky bit. I've got to monitor constantly moving limits of balance and keep the tension right to keep it sorted. So what I'm going to share is some principles around that sort of tension and balance thing. So the first one is about different levels of care. So I say in life, we have basically four levels of care. Care of self, care of us, care of family, and care of others. So in the immediate family are those three. So extended family and stuff like that is care of others. Ministry, work is care of others. But if we have a care of our family and our kids, care of our significant relationships. So if we're married, that's our marriage. If you're single and you've got a girlfriend, it's that, or it might be a really close mate. And then there's care of self. And there has to be a tension between this. And if you're not experiencing a tension between that, it's already lost. It's not in the right place. There are lots. If you're not experiencing tension between those three, you've already lost the balance. Okay. It's really important. I remember doing lots of parenting seminars with about toddlers, and I remember one particular seminar, a lady coming walking to me, tears running down her face, and she had four kids under six. And with the tears running down her face, she said, "Self-care, what's that? Care of us? I can't remember the last time my husband and I sat down and had dinner together." Now, the tension is, in my family, we talk about family time, us time, I time. So when I get home, I will actually have some I time as part of my recovery. Nerily doesn't expect us time. I'll pay that back. Now, when we, 11 years ago for our 20th wedding anniversary, is that Nerily and I said, we're going to go out for dinner. We hadn't been out for dinner for a while, so we said, let's go out for dinner and dance and wine and have a good night. And my youngest daughter, who was 10 at the time, said it should be a family time. She could rob our us if I let her. So she said, it's got to be a family time. I said, no, it's an us time. She said, it's family time, us time. And I said, Beck, here's the line of sand. You're going to go to so-and-so's place. You will have a good time. End of discussion. So I had to protect my us from my daughter. So the two key things of us is we have to protect it, but we have to invest in it. Now what happens is, when we get stressed, we're scrambling for time. So time with God goes out the window, time for self goes out the window, time for us goes out the window, and we do the bare minimum of the family. Sometimes we don't even do that because we're scrambling because we don't have actually, it's not in the priorities. And so there's this tension of going, how do I manage all my work demands and all these other demands, but how do I actually take care of my family, take care of my marriage, and take care of myself? That's the tension. Does that help clarify that? All right. So this is very, very important, and it's a constant tension. And so if I actually, you know, for example, being away this weekend, is that I'll be expected to pay back us time, not when I get home, probably next weekend. Yeah. But see, I'm intentional about that. Yeah. And so Shane and I, we'll talk about it. If I do this speaking event, you know, what needs to happen in our us time, and we'll pay that back. And so with family time, you've got to pay that back. And so care of self. And so one of the things is, how do I actually care for myself? If I'm young married with young kids, and I'll share a couple of tips from a couple of pastors that I've been working with exactly on this. So one of the things we've got to do is put stuff in context of ownership and non-ownership. Often as people in ministry and leadership, is that we often have compassionate hearts towards people, but we'll actually own stuff that's not ours to fix. And we need to go, hang on, not mine. Sorry, I can't do that. That's your responsibility, not my responsibility. But, you know, something goes wrong somewhere and, oh, that's okay, I'll fix it. Well, it may not be mine to fix. And one of the ways to reduce our stress is to constantly ask ownership issues. Second one is priorities. And priorities have to be rechecked and rechecked. And I'm going to talk about that in a moment. Because what happens is, particularly if you work in a job, government jobs and private enterprise are really good at it. Keep adding on your job list, but never taking out. Right, and so we need to actually take out. I remember quite a few years ago for our senior pastor, is that one of the members was really upset, and I'm in a church of about 400, and they wanted the senior pastor to do pastoral visitation of everybody in the church, and up until that, he actually had a pastoral visitation team that did all the pastoral visitation because that wasn't his gifting, and he oversaw that, and he did it when he needed to because there are times like that. And I said, if you want him to put that in, what are you going to take out of the job description? And this guy got upset with me and said, oh, you're just anti-pastoral care. And I looked at him and thought, I'm a psychotherapist, you moron. How can I be anti-pastoral care? I just said, he's one man with limited time. If you put into his job description, you have to take out. You can't keep adding. So what we have to do is we have to manage our line managers and go, if we do this, what is it you don't want me to do? Or if I have to do this, what's the priority order? Because then some things will not get done. And see, I've come to the place that has been really healthy for me is that I'm going to die with a very lengthy, unfinished to-do list. Nerilee says she's going to put on my gravestone, you know, he had a very long to-do list. But I figured this way. When I die and my to-do list is there, it's not going to be important, or somebody else will do it if it's important. I'm not going to kill myself doing it. And so what I do now is I go, at the end of the day, have I done what I needed to do today with my time according to God's priority? And I sleep like a baby because I don't worry about my to-do list because it's going to be there in the morning. I don't get hung up about it now. And the difficulty is that the more prominence you get or the more position you get, your to-do list and priorities is not so easy because it's not about good and bad. It's about good and best. So you actually have to deal with the best and sometimes let the good be on the to-do list and go, it's just not going to get done. The third one is the purpose of the job. Come back to what's core business, what's core business, what's core business, what's the call of God in me and my work and whatever, and strip out what's not important. Ian, you mentioned a bridge, and I want to go to bridge because everybody's got different capacities. Some people's capacity is like the Sydney Harbour Bridge. 160,000 cars cross that bridge every day. And being a suspension bridge, the more cars on it, the stronger the bridge gets. Some people are like a country bridge. Now, if you put 160,000 cars on that country bridge, it'll collapse. Probably one would. And what happens is that this is one of the issues. It's a real problem, is that we often measure by the highest capacity person. Right? And everybody's capacity is different. And it's well known that in the Prime Minister's office and the former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's office is that they burn out a lot of staff because they're high capacity people. But what happens is they expect their staff to be high capacity and they can't keep up. Right? And so the problem is in organisations, including the church, we'll use the high capacity person as the measure rather than going everybody's capacity is different. And so I actually have to know where my capacity is and live within it. Now, I'm a high capacity person, but I regulate it really well and I don't expect anybody to do my capacity. I've got some friends who are more high capacity people than me. They can really churn out more than I can. And I've got other people who just don't have that capacity. And the capacity changes. Nerilee, during her cancer treatment, her whole capacity came way, way down. And that's okay. My daughter had chronic fatigue syndrome from year 10 to year 12. And her capacity was really diminished. And now her capacity has come out. But if she overextends it, she ends up in bed for a couple of days. And so one of the tricks is knowing where my capacity is and working to my capacity rather than working to somebody else's capacity. And so therefore, if I combine that with my to-do list, I can go, this is my capacity, that's my to-do list, I need to leave it there. Okay? The next one is about maintaining balance here, is about partializing. If I said, I want you to eat this chocolate gatto just after lunch, you'd probably go, ugh. But the way you do it is you take one slither, walk away to the one slither and do that, and when it's finished, go back and do another slither. Now, when we've got overwhelming tasks and jobs, we can be sunk by the overwhelmingness rather than break it down to little steps and bite-sized bits and focus on the little bit rather than going, this is manageable and doable. I can do this now, and when it's done, I'll go to the next job. And if that happens to be tomorrow, that's tomorrow. And so to partialize is really, really important. The next practical tip is about you've got to stop regularly and reevaluate priorities and work to them. I regularly have downtimes where I reflect on what's ongoing on in my life, what are the things I need to focus on, what are the things that need to let go of. What's God doing now? What's God doing, I sense He's doing in the future? And letting God's time. So I've been spending 2 years now thinking about doing PhD study, and I've got an outline, I've got a whole heap of stuff. But you know what? It's just sitting there, percolating away, waiting for God to open the opportunity. And I go, I want to do this, but it doesn't fit in the priorities at the moment. God will bring it to the priority when it needs to be. As much as I want to do it, it's not God's priority. But you know what? Every 6 months, I'll revisit that with God, and I'll see where we're at. Disengaging. This is a really, really important concept. When we used to be, when I was a kid and we'd go out to Michael's farm and we'd drive down big hills, Dad loved angel gear, you know, neutral. You know? The problem is in our life, we don't actually use angel gear, do we? Disengaging is when we knock it out of gear into angel gear and we just cruise a bit. Now, how does disengaging happening? Traditionally, nurses wear a uniform to work, so when they actually go home, they get out of their uniform and they disengage and they finish their work. So rituals of disengaging are really important. We have a home office. We have two counselling rooms, an office and a waiting room in a purpose-built house, and next to that is two French doors where the house begins. My counselling room is different colours to the rest of the house. And I'm not in my work clobber, but I've actually got shoes that are dedicated work shoes. I normally have a black suit and shirts that have got the logo on it, and that's my work clobber. So when I do work, when I go to work in the office, I wear work clothes. And when I knock off from work, I leave the office and I walk home. And I mean, yes, it's a 10-second walk to home, but the first thing I do is take off my shoes and get off my work clobber and get into my civvies. Because my brain says, I have now finished work. And the answering machine goes on, so we don't take any work calls. And, you know, I just won't engage in stuff because I need to disengage because you can't keep working and working and working. So disengaging is critical. So there have been times during this weekend, well, let's take yesterday, did two sessions. And then in the afternoon, I went and disengaged. I disconnected from everyone who was doing work party, and I went and had a couple of hours sleep because I actually needed to do that so that I could actually then prepare for today because I was doing three sessions today. And so if I'm going to bounce back, I actually have to disengage. And I love people, but I need to disengage from people sometimes just to be able to slow down, all right? Good strategies of developing rituals that help me to transition from work out of work. So, if you're a farmer, home is work. So, how do you actually have rituals of this is not work mode at the moment, we're at home mode and I'm home for the kids, and it's really tough, but it's worth doing it. Because the second aspect of this is about recovery time. Now, recovery time is the rubber bands is important. So, imagine I've got a link of rubber bands here. You wake up in the morning with the rubber bands all relaxed. You start the day and it starts to stretch out. And then you get to the end of the day and you go have a good night's sleep and it comes down and you wake up in the morning and it's stretched out. That's how it's supposed to be. But we go like this until something goes, bang, it snaps. Now, so recovery time is really important. So what will happen is tomorrow when everybody finishes and Wad and I hit the airport, I'll start my recovery time as soon as we're at the airport. You know, I'll probably have a beer with Watto and he's probably going to go, and I'm going to go, and Watto knows it. You know, so last year when we flew home, you know, we got on the plane and he's trying to convert the woman next to him and I'm sleeping because I need my recovery time. And the last 15 minutes when I wake up, he says, PJ, come into this conversation now. All right. Because he knew I needed to be in the conversation. But he also is really aware, he's really aware of what I need to recharge. Because when I go home, I actually want a bit to give to my family. And so recovery time is really important. So when I have really heavy demand times, I have downtime to allow my system to recover because you don't do R&R, which is relaxation and relating, until you first recover. So what happens for most blokes is that we go on holidays and we spend the first week on holidays in recovery mode. Then we actually start to do R&R after that. Now, recovery is not quality relationship. It's actually allowing a system to come. So I actually build in recovery time. So when I go away on holidays, I might have a recovery weekend the weekend before I go on holidays to actually allow my system to come down. And when I was in ministry working for Scripture Union, we'd do weekend camps. And Monday was always the day off. And I changed it because it was the worst day in the world to have off because I'd go home and I'd sleep the whole Monday. That was useless to care of family, care of us. I was only doing care of self. So what I did was I actually went into the office on Mondays and did low impact work to allow work to do my recovery time. And then I took the following Friday and weekend off, which then by that time I was recharged and my family got quality time. Because I didn't want my family to go, we resent ministry. All right? So how I juggled my recovery time becomes very, very important. Oh, that's a weekend where I will plan to do nothing. So I might tinker in the garage, or I might watch footy, or I might do, it's just to just do nothing. And the purpose is to allow my energy levels to start to recover, the rubber bands to come down and my energy to come back up, so that when I go on holidays, it's not all about, you know, zombie recovery mode. My wife is really understanding of what I need, and she says, you know, you work really hard and therefore I want recovery time. And she knows that if I have that recovery time, and she mightn't get much out of me that weekend, when we go away on holidays, she's going to get quality out of me. So there's a payoff in that. Now, let me tell you about disengaging and recovery with a couple of pastors. One pastor in Melbourne that I spoke with, young guy, young family, is that when he knocks off from the office, he actually goes to McDonald's every afternoon. He takes his iPad and he spends half an hour reading with a cup of coffee. So he goes to McDonald's and he reads for half an hour, 40 minutes, and with a cup of coffee. And when he's done that, then he goes home, because by the time he gets home, he's ready to be on the deck with his kids and his wife. Another pastor in Brisbane that I was working with, a young pastor with four young boys, I think four under seven or something like that. So what he does is he knocks off from the office, and then he goes for a drive and then stops at a park and goes for a walk for about half an hour. Because when he gets home, he's not going to have recovery time, because he gets home at arsenic hour with four young boys. It's terrible. So what he does is that he builds into his schedule that he's going to be home a little bit later. But what he's done, he's building his recovery and his disengagement. So when he walks in the door, he's on the deck for four boys and his wife. And she's much happier. She's happy to put up with him being an extra half an hour for the quality of when he walks in the door. So it's finding some of these things that actually will work in our situation. The last thing I've got here is that we've really got to be careful about our identity, that who I am is not determined by what I do. And I used this example in the previous presentation, that I really feel for a lot of pastors, because, you know, pastors often are not allowed to take their hat off. They go to a family event, you need to say grace because you're the pastor. When can they take their hat off and just be a bloke? Shed man, yeah. And so, and the danger is that they can be identified, is that the pastor becomes their role, which is part of their identity, rather than actually this is who I am, that's something I do. And we have to keep that in check, because the moment that my self-esteem gets caught up in my doing, I'm going to be really under a target for stress. Because now I can't say no to anything, because this is about my esteem, rather than about something that I just do. On the notes will be some references there, so just to all the stuff that are as the references. So, non-competitive exercise is critical to burning off adrenaline. So, walking, running, swimming, going to the gym, where it's non-competitive. Competitive exercise tends to produce more adrenaline. Okay? So, I cycle. That's what I've taken up cycling. So if I need to, I get on the bike, go for a ride. It kills me like anything. Half an hour later, I feel great, because all the endorphins and enkephalins kick in and burn off the adrenaline. And the other thing is that the healthier we are, the more we're working to our optimum capacity. So exercise is really important. Diet's really important. Caffeine stays in our system for about 6 hours. So therefore, you shouldn't have any caffeine. You know, if you're going to go to bed at 10, no caffeine from 4, ideally none in the afternoon at all. And how caffeine's hidden in Coke, stuff like that, because that actually buggers your sleep. Another one with sleep is if you're having sleep issues, which a lot of guys do when they're stressed, is that golden rule is turn the clock away so you can't see the clock. If you're in bed and awake, guesstimate 15 minutes. Get out of bed. Go and do something that is mindless. So for me, I do solitaire, spider solitaire, or crosswords. And I do that till I feel tired, then I go back to bed and try again. Now, when you first start this, you might have to do it 3 times. But my sleep is so well managed that probably 2 times a year I might have to do that. And I have to get out once, and I'm back in, I sleep like a baby. Because I've trained my brain that my pillow's for sleeping, not for thinking. And what happens to sleep is that you start up here in sleep and you drop into deep sleep and then you dream. Everybody dreams. And so, and then we get brain chemistry replenishing and then we come back up in his sleep and we drop down again. And you actually have to get a number of cycles to the right depth to replenish your body chemistry and your brain chemistry. And what happens is that when you're stressed is that you don't drop into deep enough or cycles enough. And so training our brain for good sleep is really, really important. So exercise, sleep, caffeine are the really big ones. Alcohol is another one, is that avoid a lot of alcohol late in the evening. Alcohol will put you to sleep, but it's a stimulus. So what happens is about 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the sleepy effect goes off and the stimulant kicks in and you're wide awake. All right? So you need to be careful with alcohol, which is a bugger because I love red wine and I love port. I like a lot of alcohol, actually, a variety of them. Varieties of alcohol. Varieties of alcohol, yeah. And some people use meditation, some people use music. When I was really in a bad place a number of years ago, I used a lot of music to help switch off. But I maintain a really good sleep pattern. And what I just said again this morning, he said, "Man, you've got good sleep. You sleep really well." And I go, "Yeah, I work really hard at maintaining good sleep." And because when my sleep is good, my anxiety is good. When my sleep is buggered, my anxiety is terrible. And so I regulate that really well. I think it's a complex thing. I think, one, there's a social issue to that. And if we look at early white Australian rum and rum rebellions in Australia, and then if we look at our German heritage, you know, we're best winemakers in the world, I think there is a cultural aspect to that. I think the second thing is that we use it tend to be as a switch off and escape. So then I've trained my brain is that this is when I switch off, okay, rather than actually learning other ways to disengage. So some people will use drink as a way to disengage from work. And I mean, if I can understand for blokes who, you know, if you're on the land and work is home, how do you switch off? You know, and don't get me wrong, I mean, I really do like a drink and I love a quality drink, but it's about why am I drinking? What's the purpose of this? Do I need this drink and being careful of how it plays in sleep. So I'm really careful about drinking lots or late at night because it just plays havoc with all your stress and sleep stuff. We generally in our place have a late dinner, so I'll probably have a glass, not every night, but probably every second night, a glass of red with dinner. And then I might have a glass after that, but you know, hour or two before bed, that's the time to kick it back. And ideally, for anyone who's got reflux, should have nothing 2 hours before you go to bed. So, but an hour or two before bed is a good time to kick it back. Alright, apart from special occasions. You know. And we have a few of those because Robin Stelzer, who's the pastor at Our Saviours at Rochdale, his son Tyson is probably Australia's premier wine writer. And Tyson's a mate of us, so we do some dinner parties and do some serious wine tasting. And he tastes 15,000 wines a year. Most of it gets spat out, but you know we score a few bottles from Tyson, so they're good conversations nights, you know. We do a lot of talking and a little bit of drinking. So it's good. When you're going through a grief process, okay, grief process is really quite strange. And I describe a grief process as like you get hit by a tidal wave. You know, you're in the ocean and you're bouncing around, you don't know which way's up, and all of a sudden you're on your feet, and then another wave hits you. Okay? And then it subsides and another wave hits you. And with grief is that over the long time, so for grief by bereavement, the first year is the worst. Second to fifth year is when you're starting to find ebbs and flows. But the waves never go away. They just get smaller and further apart. And so there are those times when it's like the early stages of grief is really hard work. It's exhausting. And you get to a point where you go, I just need to rest a bit. And so I'll turn the tractor off. God's given me a sense of peace. And I'm in a good place. And is there still crap? Yeah. But that I'm not acting out of an overstimulated adrenal system that's, you know, that panicky type stuff. There's a big difference between those two places. And this is where, if we went back pre-electricity, back before the Industrial Revolution, when 80% of the world was on the land, is that you lived to the sun, you had these rhythms, you didn't stay up all night because you didn't have electricity, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have phones, and you lived a far more steady-paced life, because if you went to town, it was probably a day's trip because you got on your horse and your cart. Yeah, but the rhythm of life was different. And Archibald Hart says this. He said, we're made for camel speed, living at jet speed. No wonder we're messed up. And I really like that, that we've actually got to come back to, let's slow it down from jet speed and come back to camel speed a little bit, because we're made for camel speed, not jet speed. Yeah. Oh, I said at a parenting seminar recently, I said, listen, small kids are torturous. And everybody laughed, thought I was joking. And I said, no, I'm deadly serious. I said, torture throughout the ages has been sleep deprivation and social isolation. And that's what small kids do to you. Don't they? Particularly mums. So I always go, you just got to be kind to yourselves. And, I had a couple come and see me. They were in a bit of conflict, three small kids. And we sorted out the conflict and they were going away for a four-day weekend. And I said to them, I said, listen, the danger is that you'll want to cram everything you can in the 4 days. I said, the first day needs to be a recovery day where you sleep. Then the next three will be much better. First day, she slept 14 hours. And she came in smiling and said, I've got to tell you, that's the best weekend I've had in a long time, because after I slept 14 hours, I was a much nicer person. And we did this over 3 days. It was fantastic. Thank you for telling me to take care of myself. And that was the last time I saw them. They just need to learn some rhythms to go, is that you get sleep deprived and you need to tag team and you need to say, listen, let me take the kids, you go and have a sleep. And then later on we might do a switch. Or if you go and say, you've got a weekend with the grandparents looking after the kids, it's okay, you might be thinking you're going away for a hot weekend, it's okay to spend a lot of time sleeping, because that's what your body needs. And so then you'll have a much better time at dinner time, because you're actually in a better frame and a better place, because you've actually cared for your body. That's where the self-care then leads into the care of us. But kids can really wear you out. It's tough. It's really simple. You just tell them, call it what it is. That's mummy guilt. And it's false guilt. Okay, and that's about wanting to be the best mum she can be. And I just go, that's mummy guilt, that's wrecking you. It's false guilt. You know? Well, you know, I like my sleep, okay? So my kids had a dark navy blue ceiling and blackout curtains. And on a Saturday, they weren't out of their room till 8 o'clock. They didn't know what 8 o'clock was, but they knew what it was on the pans. Play in your room, read books, unless it's an emergency, don't you come into my room till 8 o'clock. All right? And I was going to say, I'm not going to let these kids wreck my life and my sleep. When they were really little, it was just fine, but there comes a time when you go, I'm not going to fit into their lifestyle, they have to fit into our lifestyle. All right? And so there are times to teach our kids boundaries and stuff. There's times when kids are little, you've got to respond and they're little, and that's the way it is. But it's about how do we find the rhythms and teach them rhythms. Okay, and if we've got little kids who are sleeping through the night and they go to bed early, then what happens with mummy guilt is, oh, I can run around and do the washing, ironing, this, and this that I couldn't get done through the day. You know, maybe we actually need to go to bed early. And then when they're up, we can entertain them, let them do something and go and do some other stuff. Let's change the rhythm a little bit so that it works a bit better. But mummy guilt's a real killer, all right? Really. And when you get to see mums who actually go back to part-time work, you want to see their mummy guilt then. Ah, that's a real killer. Shift work is torturous. All right, it just is. Some of the research around guys who pull double shifts regularly, they get pulled over for drunk driving. When they blow on the bag, they're 000. That's the impact it has on the body. And so therefore, for shift workers to find a rhythm for sleep is so hard. And I don't have any easy answers about that. But one of my mates, Dr. John O'Andrews, who did his doctorate on sleep, he's a psychologist, when he worked in Sydney at a hospital and he did night shifts, he would make sure he wore really dark sunglasses on the way home, blacked out his room, did slow things. He knew about body temperature. So if you lower your body temperature, you're more likely to sleep. no exercising or eating just before you go to sleep, which is really hard with shift work. But if you find a solution, let me know and we'll write a book about it and we'll become quite wealthy, I think. One of my mates, who's an ex-copper, who's younger than me, looks older than me, and I think that's because of all the shift work. No, it may take a bit of time because you accumulate a sleep debt. And so therefore, if your sleep's buggered, then that actually increases your stress levels. Your adrenal system's not going to be running as well. So it works both ways. Adrenal system's up, sleep gets buggered, or buggered sleep goes back the other way. Can be often, it's more often about salt levels, exercise, and muscle stretching. So sometimes it might be just muscle stretching that needs to happen before you go to bed. And one of my mates gets terrible leg cramps, and he has to, if he stretches before he goes to bed, he doesn't have a problem. Alright, but he's 40 trying to still be 20. Playing C-grade cricket, and he just busted up his shoulder and had 8 pins put in his shoulder diving to save a ball. And so I keep telling him, Darren, you're 40. You know, slow down. Come and drink a little bit more red with me and stop running around like a lunatic. But he gets terrible leg cramps, and I think a lot of us do his exercise and stuff, but he needs to stretch a bit. Okay, that's conditioning. The brain's an amazing organ that can be conditioned and trained. All right, and some of that retraining, it takes about 1,000 repetitions to retrain the brain. Okay, I want to pray. I appreciate you hanging in a few minutes, but let me pray for you, hey? Father, thank you for the amazing way our body works chemically, and thank you for all the doctors and the researchers that have understood it so that we can go, wow, there's an explanation here. And I want to pray for my brothers and myself that you'll help us to manage stress and adrenaline really well. Lord, I think for each one of us there's something we can take away and apply so that we can live a more balanced life. And that would flow from us to our marriages, to our kids, to our communities. So guide us and grow us in this, I pray in your name, Jesus. Amen. Amen. Thanks, guys. Thank you.